The Republic of Pirates by Colin Woodard, continued. Disc 9.
Blackbeard and Bonnet spent the winter of 1717-18 in Spanish territory, their movements and activities lost to British authorities. Spanish mariners told their Jamaican counterparts that a pirate known only as the Great Devil was cruising the Gulf of Mexico, his ship filled with much treasure. Not long thereafter, Bonnet and Blackbeard were reported to be cruising about the Mexican Gulf port of Veracruz with 4 sloops and a ship of 42 guns. They were said to be hunting for a galley called the Royal Prince, and to have boasted that they would have the Adventure man-of-war if they can. It was quite a boast. The 36-gun HMS Adventure, a 438-ton fifth-rate based in Jamaica, was the most powerful Royal Navy frigate in the entire Western Hemisphere at the time. By late March, Blackbeard and Bonnet had separated in the Bay of Honduras. Blackbeard took the Queen Anne's Revenge to Turnip Island, a great ring of mangroves and islets of coral sand located 25 miles off the coast of what is now Belize, amid a popular rest spot for English merchantmen. Bonnet sailed the Revenge 100 miles further south and was cruising for prizes off the Bay Islands, 3 coral-ringed islands off the coast of what is now Honduras. On March 28, 1718, Bonnet's men spotted a large ship near Roatan, the largest of the Bay Islands. The ship, the Protestant Caesar of Boston, was an enormous 400-ton merchantman, the muzzles of 26 cannon protruding from her gun ports. She was more than 4 times the size of the Revenge, which carried just 10 guns and 50 men. Despite the odds, Bonnet and his crew decided to attack, risking a replay of the eccentric planter's disastrous engagement with the Spanish man-of-war the year before. They caught up to the Protestant Caesar at 9 at night, cleverly cutting behind the big ship's vulnerable stern. Bonnet's men fired 5 cannon and a volley of musket shot, only to be answered by 2 stern guns and a hail of bullets. As the smoke cleared, Bonnet yelled out that if the ship fired another gun, they would give no quarter, a threat to kill everyone aboard. The Protestant Caesar's veteran captain, William Wire of Boston, knew a bluff when he saw it. He let off another salvo of his cannon. The running battle continued for 3 hours, cannon flashing in the night, until Bonnet finally gave up and retreated into the darkness. Bonnet's men were disgruntled. Clearly, their commander had learned little from his year-long apprenticeship with Blackbeard. They voted to travel to Turniff, where they could recuperate from their ill-advised battle. They also made it clear to Bonnet that his command was on very thin ice. On April 2nd, the Revenge sailed into Turniff's 5-mile-wide lagoon. To the crew's relief, the Queen Anne's Revenge was anchored inside. A number of them begged Blackbeard to use his influence to terminate Bonnet's command. Blackbeard asked Bonnet's men to call a meeting of their company, where he proposed they replace Bonnet with one of Blackbeard's officers, a man named Richards. The men accepted the plan, whereupon Bonnet was transported to the Queen Anne's Revenge. There, Blackbeard reportedly told his wayward colleague that, as he had not been used to the fatigues and care of such a post, it would be better for him to stay with Blackbeard, where he could live easy at his pleasure, in such a ship as this, where he would not be obliged to perform the necessary duties of a sea voyage. Bonnet had been placed under house arrest, and would remain so for many months to come. The pirates stayed at Turniff for several more days, recuperating, gorging on fish and sea turtle, and capturing wayward vessels. Their first prize was an 80-ton logwood-cutting sloop from Jamaica called the Adventure that had blundered into Turniff Lagoon. The pirates found the sloop to their liking and kept it, and made its commander, David Harriet, a prisoner aboard the Queen Anne's Revenge. Blackbeard's mate, Israel Hands, took control of the adventure in his stead. A few days later, they seized at least four more sloops, three from Jamaica and one, the Land of Promise, from Rhode Island. Blackbeard's men burned one of the Jamaican sloops because of a grudge against its captain, but they raised red flags aboard the others and added them to what was now a five-vessel fleet. Around April 6th, they left Terneff, Blackbeard telling one of his captives that they were bound to the Bay of Honduras to burn the ship Protestant Caesar, to ensure that Captain Wire might not brag when he went to New England that he had beat a pirate. On the morning of April 8th, the pirates found the Protestant Caesar at anchor off the coast of Honduras, her holds half filled with freshly cut logwood. When Wire spotted the pirates, a large ship and a sloop with black flags and death's heads, and three more sloops with bloody flags, he called all his men on deck to ask if they were willing to defend the ship from the attackers. According to Wire, his men answered that if they were Spaniards, they would stand by him as long as they had life, but if they were pirates, they would not fight. When it became clear that the attackers were the sloop they had fought earlier, now backed by the infamous Blackbeard, Wire's men all declared they would not fight and quitted the ship, believing they would be murdered by the sloop's company. For 3 days, Captain Wire and his men sheltered amid the jungle foliage and piles of logwood on shore, watching the pirates plunder their massive ship. On April 11th, Blackbeard sent a message to Wire telling him that if he surrendered peacefully, no harm would come to him. Blackbeard had a fearsome reputation among the merchant captains of the Americas, but the pirate had never been known to go back on his word, and as far as anyone knew, had never killed a man. Wire decided to trust him and surrendered. He was taken to Blackbeard, who told him he had been smart not to burn or sabotage the Protestant Caesar, else his men on board his sloop would have done him damage for fighting with them. Unfortunately, Thatch also had some bad news. He had to burn the Protestant Caesar because she was from Boston, and his gang was committed to destroy all Massachusetts vessels in revenge for executing the six pirates who had survived the Cape Cod shipwrecks. The next day, Wire watched as the pirates went aboard his ship and set her alight, logwood and all. True to his word, Blackbeard released Wire and his men unharmed, along with the crew of the sloop Land of Promise. All the captives eventually got back to Boston. Blackbeard's company also resolved to head north. Spring was in the air, and the time had come to shift their raids to the eastern seaboard of North America. First, however, they would stop in at New Providence Island and check up on the status of their pirate brethren. After humiliating Vincent Pierce, Vane and his band didn't return to Nassau for 3.5 weeks, during which time they unleashed a reign of terror on the Bahamian archipelago. Unlike Bellamy and Blackbeard, who avoided unnecessary force, Vane presided over an orgy of violence and cruelty that helped royal authorities paint all the Bahamian pirates as monsters. In this single cruise, which lasted from April 4th to 28th, 1718, his modest band captured a dozen merchant vessels, all surrendering without a fight. Nonetheless, they treated most of their captives barbarously. The worst treatment was reserved for crews hailing from Bermuda, which accounted for 7 of the 12 prizes. Bermudans visited the Bahamas regularly to rake salt, the primary food preservative in those days, among the uninhabited Turks and Caicos Islands, which comprised the eastern part of the archipelago. As they tended to follow the same routes to the islands, they made an especially easy target. Vane's men had recently developed a particular animus toward them, apparently because their governor had recently detained a pirate named Thomas Brown on suspicion of piracy. Brown had been released, probably for lack of evidence, but Vane wished to retaliate all the same. It was as if someone had messed with a made man in the mafia. His colleagues were bound to mete out a lesson to the neighborhood. Edward North's sloop, William and Mary, fell into Vane's hands off Rum Cay on April 14th. On boarding the vessel, Vane's men immediately began beating North, his passengers, and crew, insisting they give up all their treasures. The little vessel had little of value aboard. 17 Spanish pistoles, 17 pounds, some foodstuffs, and 10 ounces of ambergris, a hard substance produced in the heads of some whales that often washed up on Bahamian beaches and was collected to make jewelry. Dissatisfied with the take, Vane seized one of North's sailors, bound his hands and feet, and lashed him to the topside of the William and Mary's bowsprit. The pirates then stuck a loaded musket in the sailor's mouth and burning matches inside the helpless sailor's eyelids. If he didn't confess what money was hidden on board, they would let the matches burn down to his eyeballs and blind him, after which he would be shot. After this, Vane felt confident that they had gotten everything of value, save for North's black crewmen, whom they seized as plunder. Even as these interrogations were taking place, Vane's company captured a second Bermuda sloop, the Diamond, and brought her alongside the William and Mary. As before, they began beating Captain John Tibby and his crew, and picked out one of his sailors for further torture. They tied up the unlucky man, Nathaniel Catling, put a noose around his neck, and hoisted him up the mast, kicking and gagging. There he hung, face turning blue, until he passed out. The pirates cut him down and left him for dead on the deck. Sometime later, Catling began to regain consciousness. One of the pirates drew his cutlass and slashed the prostrate seaman across his collarbone. He raised his cutlass to continue hacking the man to death, but one of the other pirates stopped him, saying, as Catling later recalled, that it was too great a cruelty. The pirates looted the Diamond of valuables, 300 pieces of eight, 75 pounds, and a Negro man, and forced all her crew aboard the Lark, which the pirates were now calling the Ranger. Then they hacked down both of the Bermudan vessel's masts and set the Diamond on fire. Before letting the men go on the crippled William and Mary, they bragged about mistreating the crews of two other Bermuda sloops the week before. They told North and Tibby that when they got home to Bermuda, they should tell Governor Bennett that the pirates will join all the forces they can and come and take his country, and make a new Madagascar out of it. During their drunken celebrations, North and other witnesses recalled Vane's men toasting "Damnation to King George," the government, and all the higher powers, while threatening to occupy Bermuda that very summer. Vane's men, it seems, were well apprised of the appeals the pirates had forwarded to the exiled James Stewart, and were optimistic they would soon be receiving support from that quarter. By the time he returned to Nassau on April 28th, Vane had taken three more sloops from Bermuda, three from Jamaica, one from New York, and a Boston-bound ship. In the process, his crew had swelled to 90 or more, most recruited from the Jamaican vessels whose sailors may have known Vane from his Port Royal days. They had probably garnered only 1,000 pounds or so in treasure, but their actions had snuffed out legitimate trade into the Bahamas. If the pirates weren't in control of the archipelago's commerce, Vane reasoned, then nobody would be. Vane must have been pleased to find that the HMS Phoenix had withdrawn from Nassau, leaving the pirates' control of the island uncontested. He was even happier when a massive warship came into the harbor a few days later, the Death's Head flag at her masthead, accompanied by a pirate sloop of war and two prize sloops. Blackbeard had returned. Blackbeard was in command of some 700 men, which nearly quadrupled the pirate population of New Providence Island overnight. For a few short days, the streets of Nassau returned to life as Thatch traded stories with Vane, Palsgrave Williams, and the city's other diehard pirate captains. His company likely divided their plunder at this point, as some 300 of his men left his company. Some undoubtedly planned to wait until Governor Rogers arrived to take the king's pardon. Others, including Blackbeard's gunner, William Cunningham, wanted to enjoy himself ashore before returning to piracy. Some may have been Jacobite stalwarts, who wished to stay behind with Vane to await reinforcements from the Stuart court in exile. A few may have snuck off with Palsgrave Williams, who let it be known that he was soon to leave the island for Africa to prey on European slave ships. One can imagine Williams and Blackbeard sharing a drink under the sailcloth awnings of one of Nassau's open-air alehouses, exchanging the stories of the destruction of the Widow, the capture of the Queen Anne's Revenge, and close encounters with His Majesty's warships. They likely compared notes on their former commodore, Benjamin Hornigold, then in Jamaica, wondering if he had really given up piracy. Blackbeard heard that a fellow Bristolian, Woods Rogers, was to be the new governor of the Bahamas. If Edward Thatch was indeed a pseudonym to protect Blackbeard's family, this news ruled out any possibility of accepting the pardon in Nassau, as Rogers would recognize him. Blackbeard had two choices: stay with Vane and try to resist Rogers, or leave Nassau for good. A day or two later, Blackbeard called all hands aboard his five-vessel fleet. A few new faces appeared, pirates who had no intention of giving up life on the account, including Hornigold's old quartermaster, John Martin. The greatest pirate fleet afloat weighed anchor from Nassau, sails set for the Straits of Florida, Palmar de Ice, and the Spanish wrecks. At virtually the same moment, thousands of miles away, another fleet was weighing anchor in the River Thames, south of London, the one that would carry Woods Rogers to the Bahamas. It was an impressive expedition, one that had taken Rogers many months to assemble. There were seven vessels in all, five of them the property of Rogers and his business partners. He sailed on the Delicia, his 460-ton private man-of-war with a crew of 90 and 30 guns, accompanied by the 300-ton transport Willing Mind, 20 guns, 22 crewmen, the 135-ton ship Samuel, 6 guns, 26 crewmen, and the private sloop of war Buck, 6 guns, 12 men. Together, these four vessels carried the independent company of 100 soldiers, many of them recently discharged from the Chelsea Military Hospital, 130 male colonists with their wives and children, most of them Protestant refugees from France, Switzerland, or Germany's Palatinate, food and supplies to feed and clothe all of these people for 14 months, all of the necessary tools and materials to, in the words of Rogers' co-investors, build forts and houses, clear fields, and plant them with sugar, ginger, indigo, cotton, and tobacco for snuff equal to that of Havana. Rogers, convinced the pirates would respond to spiritual teachings, had even brought aboard a parcel of religious pamphlets from the Society for Promoting Christian Knowledge. Altogether, the expedition represented an investment by the co-partners of £11,000, toward which Rogers had contributed £3,500. In addition to the soldiers, crew, and colonists, Rogers was accompanied by several gentlemen who intended to help him bring order to the fallen colony. Chief among them was Sir William Fairfax, a 26-year-old nobleman whose family owned 5.3 million acres of Virginia, who intended to serve as Rogers's chief justice. Fairfax, like his aristocratic colleagues, considered the Bahamas too dangerous for his wife to join him for the time being. "Though I expect to be but a little while separated from my wife, I trust in God she will not want anything to comfort her sorrows," he wrote his mother from aboard the Delicia just before departing. Escorting Rogers's vessels to Nassau were three Royal Navy warships, the fifth-rate frigate HMS Milford, 420 tons, 30 guns, under Commodore Peter Chamberlain, the sixth-rate HMS Rose, 273 tons, 20 guns, and the sloop of war Shark, 113 tons, 10 guns, each of which carried 100 men. These men of war represented the most concentrated naval force ever deployed against the Bahamian pirates. Taken with Rogers's well-armed vessels, they represented an overwhelming force. 7 armed ships, manned by 550 soldiers and sailors. As they sailed out of the mouth of the Thames on the 22nd of April, 1718, few aboard the ships had any doubt that the Republic of Pirates was about to meet its end. Blackbeard had come to a decision that he hadn't shared with his crew. The time for overt piracy was coming to a close. King George's pardon had split the pirates' ranks, causing the surrender of a great many of their best leaders and the scattering of so many others. He may have been impressed at Charles Vane's commitment to hold down the pirate base at all costs, but Thatch was too prudent a strategist to commit to a lost cause. Unless they received reinforcements from the Stuart king, the few hundred pirates in Nassau had little hope of repelling a concentrated military force of the kind Governor Rogers could be expected to have with him. Blackbeard wasn't like Vane. He didn't want to go out in a blaze of glory. Thatch would rather be the pirate who got away with it all, perhaps setting himself up as an 18th-century version of the Godfather, a wealthy and powerful crime boss operating with the collusion of some authorities, his role undetectable or impossible to prove to the rest. He had a good idea where to set himself up in this role. First, however, he needed one more big score. The disgraced Stede Bonnet could have given him the idea to blockade Charleston, whose commerce was forced to travel over a shoal and through the narrow mouth of the harbor. Bonnet had blockaded the South Carolina capital in the Revenge the year before, but had to confine himself to a hit-and-run operation, fleeing the scene before the city's residents came after him in their own sloops. With his powerful fleet, however, Blackbeard had nothing to fear from the little armed sloops of Charleston's merchants. The Royal Navy had no permanent presence in the Carolinas, and even if a frigate happened to be in the harbor, it would be grossly outgunned by the Queen Anne's Revenge and her 3 consort sloops. The pirates could bring the entire colony to its knees and might even consider plundering the town itself. The pirates agreed to set a course for Charleston. As they sailed north, some of the men came down with an unspecified ailment, possibly syphilis acquired from the prostitutes of Nassau. Their surgeon lacked the medicines considered necessary for treatment, and their acquisition was quickly becoming a priority. The pirate fleet took several vessels in the Florida Straits, including 2 sloops and a brigantine, hoping to garner intelligence as well as plunder. They hit pay dirt. 2 of these were 2 commanded by members of the old Flying Gang. Josiah Burgess, one of Nassau's veteran pirate sloop captains, was sailing back to the Bahamas from Charleston in the 10-ton sloop Providence with bottled ale and 2 earthenware plates, 2 items apparently in demand at the pirate's lair. Burgess was happy to share what he knew of Charleston, where he had spent several weeks after receiving his pardon. He traveled there with a number of their pirate friends, many of whom were there now, and would be happy to see their old pals. Blackbeard was pleased to hear there were no naval vessels in the harbor, but there were a number of merchant ships preparing to depart for London and New England. Blackbeard's men bought all of Burgess's cargo and sent him back to Charleston to act as their eyes and ears ashore. South Carolina's customs records show that he returned to Charleston only a few days after he had departed, his vessel empty just hours before Blackbeard's fleet cut off the harbor. A few days after meeting Burgess, the pirates also intercepted the 35-ton sloop Anne of Jamaica, commanded by another reformed pirate, Lee Ashworth. Ashworth had sailed a different vessel from Nassau to Charleston a few weeks earlier that had been filled with contraband. Taking the pardon, Ashworth had purchased the Anne in a family member's name and filled her hold with barrels of tar, pitch, and beef to sell in Port Royal. He was ready to retire to his Jamaican manor, he told Blackbeard. Ashworth may have stiffened Blackbeard's resolve to slip into semi-legitimacy, but not before raiding Charleston. The pirate fleet arrived off Charleston Bar, 9 miles south of town, on May 22, 1718, and seized the pilot boat before it could sail to town to raise an alarm. Then they spread their four vessels out across the approaches to the bar and waited, spider-like, for ships to fall into their web. Within a few days, they captured at least 5 vessels, 2 ships outbound to London, 2 ships inbound from England, and a tiny 8-ton sloop, the William, headed home to Philadelphia. The captain of the latter, Thomas Hurst, was a familiar face. He had been in Nassau recently, where he had purchased 8 great guns from the pirates there, guns that were still in his little sloop's hold. One day, he was trading with pirates. Now, he was their prisoner. The first of these captures proved the most valuable. The 178-ton ship Crowley had been headed out of the river bound for London. Her holds were stuffed with over 1,200 barrels, but these turned out to be filled with pitch, tar, and rice, Carolina exports that weren't particularly useful to the pirates. In her cabins, however, the Crowley carried a number of paying passengers, among them many of the most distinguished citizens of Charleston. While the pirates looted the Crowley of provisions and supplies, the frightened passengers were rowed over to the Queen Anne's Revenge, where they were thoroughly interrogated. Who were they? What was their vessel carrying? And what other vessels were at anchor in Charleston? One turned out to be Samuel Ragg, a member of the colony's governing council, who owned 24,000 acres in the province and was returning to England with his 4-year-old son, William. Blackbeard realized these captives were worth more to the pirates than the cargo in the Crowley's hold. It was time to call a general council to decide their fate. In preparation for the meeting, all the pirates' captives, a total of 80 people from various vessels, were stuffed into the Crowley's hold and locked in darkness. This was done with such hurry and precipitation that it struck a great terror in the unfortunate people, verily believing they were then going to their destruction, the author of the General History of the Pirates later wrote, apparently after speaking with witnesses. Ragg and the other passengers, having heard bloodthirsty tales of the pirates, expected their captors would light the ship on fire, and what seemed to confirm them in this notion was that no regard was had to the qualities of the prisoners, with merchants, gentlemen of rank, and even a child of Mr. Ragg's being confined with common servants and sailors, a harbinger of death in their minds. As the captives cowered in the hold, bewailing their condition, the pirates met aboard their flagship to devise a plan. They would send a boat into Charleston and demand ransom for their captives. If they were refused, they would threaten to not only kill all the captives and burn their vessels, but also to sail into Charleston Harbor, sink all the ships there, and perhaps attack the town itself. Whatever disease the pirates had contracted, it must have become extremely worrisome, for the only ransom they demanded was a chest containing a list of medicines drawn up by their surgeon, with a total value of about £400. The meeting concluded, Blackbeard had the prisoners brought before the assembled pirates and informed them of the plan. Ragg begged the pirates to send one of the captive gentlemen in with whomever delivered the ransom demand, so that they could impress on the governor how serious the situation was. The pirates agreed, with some suggesting they send Ragg himself, while keeping his son hostage. Blackbeard, always the strategist, was against this tactic. He didn't want to lose possession of his most valuable bargaining chip, because if his bluff was called, he had no intention of actually murdering young William Ragg and the other captives. Instead, the pirates chose another captive, a Mr. Marks, to travel with their emissaries. If the entourage didn't return with the medicines in 2 days, the pirates said they would make good on their threats. The boat departed, carrying Marks and 2 pirates on what would prove a farcical journey. On the way to town, a sudden squall capsized their little boat. The 3 men managed to swim to safety on an uninhabited island and awaited rescue for much of the day, well aware that the clock was ticking. The next afternoon, hungry and bedraggled, they realized they would have to rescue themselves. They found a large wooden hatch cover on the shore, but it wasn't buoyant enough to support all of them. Lacking other options, Marks got onto the hatch and the pirates pushed it out into the water. When they got over their heads, they clung to the edge of the hatch and swam hard, pushing the makeshift raft toward Charleston, 9 miles away. They paddled this way throughout the night, making little progress. By morning, they were sure they were all going to die, but were saved by some passing fishermen who brought them to their camp. Marks, realizing the captive's time was already up, paid the fisherman to go tell Blackbeard what had happened. Meanwhile, he hired a second boat to take the three of them to Charleston. By the time the fishermen found the pirates, Blackbeard was in a fury. The deadline had come and gone more than a day earlier, and the pirate commodore had threatened Rag and the others, calling them villains 1,000 times and swearing that they should not live 2 hours. Though he did his best to terrify the captives, he hadn't harmed them in any way. When the fisherman related Marx's mishap and asked on his behalf for 2 additional days, Blackbeard consented. However, when 2 more days passed and the emissaries did not return, Blackbeard's gang still didn't kill anyone. Instead, they resolved to sail to Charleston and terrorize the town. Meanwhile, in Charleston, Marks was desperately searching for the 2 pirates he had traveled with. As soon as they had gotten to town, he had rushed to the home of Governor Robert Johnson, who had immediately agreed to Blackbeard's demands. The 2 pirates, however, had gone out drinking, and in the process had run into some of their old colleagues. There were upward of 12 Nassau pirates in town who had come to take the king's pardon. As the 2 pirates wandered the streets of the walled city, they discovered that many common people admired them. Enjoying the celebrity and the company of old friends, they had gone from one house to another drinking until they forgot the time. They didn't remember their mission until a day or two later they heard screaming on the streets outside. Blackbeard's fleet had arrived in the harbor, frightening the inhabitants so badly that women and children ran about the street like mad things. The 2 drunken pirates stumbled to the waterfront, preventing their colleagues from exacting retribution on the town. Marks rode out to the pirate man-of-war with a chest of medicines and a message from Governor Johnson offering to pardon Blackbeard if he wished to lay down his arms. Blackbeard rejected the overture but released all his captives and their vessels, although local officials reported they had destroyed most of their cargoes and did some damage to the ships, all for pure mischief's sake. In the end, the pirates left with only the medicines, provisions, a few barrels of rice, 4,000 pieces of 8, 1,000 pounds, and the clothes of their gentlemen captives, whom they had stripped before releasing. They left Charleston with only 1 prize, a Spanish sloop they had taken off Florida. Blackbeard had paralyzed an entire colony for over a week, but for reasons unknown was willing to settle for plunder probably worth less than 2,000 pounds. As they sailed north, the pirate fleet detained 2 more South Carolina-bound vessels. The 60-ton ship William of Boston, loaded with lumber and corn, and the 45-ton brigantine Princess of Bristol, carrying a cargo of 86 African slaves from Angola. From the Princess, the pirates took 14 of what a Charleston official called their best Negroes, adding to an already substantial number of Africans aboard the pirate fleet's 4 vessels. As the slaves were transferred, Blackbeard told the Princess's commander, Captain John Bedford, that he had got a baker's dozen, suggesting that he regarded these particular blacks as commodities rather than recruits. As for the William and her cargo, the pirate company's last words upon leaving Charleston had been that they would swear revenge upon New England men and vessels for executing Bellamy's men. However, it was the revenge that actually captured the William, and for some reason her commander, Blackbeard's lieutenant, Mr. Richards, let the William go. Afterward, captives overheard Blackbeard raging at Richards for not burning said vessel because she belonged to Boston. Blackbeard soon put aside his anger, as there were more important matters to attend to. He had secretly decided that the time had come to break up his company, but with no intention of sharing the recent plunder with all 400 men. While in Central America, some of the rank-and-file pirates had become mutinous after the rum supply had run out. "Our company somewhat sober," Blackbeard wrote at the time in his journal. "A damned confusion amongst us. Rogues a-plotting, and great talk of separation." Fortunately, the fleet's next prize had a great deal of liquor on board that kept the company hot, damned hot, and then all things went well again. This journal later fell into the hands of the Royal Navy, but sadly was subsequently lost. This appears to be the only excerpt ever recorded. Blackbeard never forgave the plotters, however, and had no intention of rewarding such behavior. He developed a plan to rid himself of them, along with the incompetent steed Bonnet and his loyalists. He shared it with only a few trusted colleagues, including his quartermaster, William Howard, and Boatswain Israel Hands, who was in command of one of the fleet's vessels, the 80-ton prize sloop Adventure. These men helped him convince the company to sail into one of North Carolina's sparsely populated bays to careen, supposedly in preparation for intercepting the annual Spanish treasure fleet in the Florida Straits. 6 days after leaving Charleston, sometime around June 3, 1718, Blackbeard's fleet turned into what is now called Beaufort Inlet, halfway up North Carolina's low, swampy coast. To avoid the sandy, uncharted shoals, the vessels had to negotiate a narrow, comma-shaped channel created by a tidal creek, whose sluggish mouth provided a quiet anchorage. Although this harbor was located right in front of the hamlet of Beaufort, the pirates had nothing to fear from the handful of families living there, who had no practical way to send for help overland. The sloops, the Adventure, Revenge, and the small Spanish prize, went in first, crossing the 15-foot-deep outer bar and proceeding up the curving channel to the anchorage. Thatch safely sailed the Queen Anne's Revenge over the outer bar, but as he approached the entrance to the tidal channel, under full sail, he apparently ordered the helmsman to maintain a course that took her straight onto the shoals. The great ship shuddered to a stop, the force of the collision so powerful it threw men off their feet and snapped the lines of one of the ship's bow anchors, which splashed into the water. According to plan, Blackbeard sent William Howard up the channel in a boat to tell Israel Hands to come down with the Adventure, supposedly to help get the Queen Anne's Revenge off the shoal before the tide went out. Hands sailed the Adventure straight into the shoal, a gunshot away from the flagship, tearing enormous holes in her hull. By the time the Revenge and the Spanish sloop reached the scene, Blackbeard's ship had started listing to port, her holds filling with water. The pirates rowed one of the Queen Anne's Revenge's anchors 400 yards into the channel, set it, and tried to drag the ship off the shoal with their anchor winch, but the effort failed. The company realized that their Queen Anne's Revenge was doomed. Everyone transferred to the Revenge and the Spanish sloop, which took them up to Beaufort. As the pirates took stock of the situation, Blackbeard set the next part of his plan into motion. Steed Bonnet had been in a state of utter depression for weeks, declaring to one and all that he would gladly give up piracy, but on account of his actions was so ashamed to see the face of any Englishman again that he would have to spend the remainder of his days living incognito in Spain or Portugal. Accordingly, the pirates must have been very surprised when Blackbeard announced that he was returning command of the Revenge to the pathetic fellow. Bonnet, hardly able to believe his ears, decided to secure a pardon as soon as possible. Beaufort's villagers could have told him that the governor of North Carolina, Charles Eden, lived in the tiny village of Bath, a day's sail up the Sound and Pamlico River. Bonnet and a handful of loyalists hopped in a shallow draft boat and sailed immediately, promising to return shortly for the rest of his men. No sooner had Bonnet left than Blackbeard and his 100 or so co-conspirators drew their weapons and took their shipmates into custody. They stranded 16 of them, and the adventurer's captain, David Harriet, on Bogue Bank, a sandy, uninhabited island a mile from the mainland. Another 200 pirates were left to fend for themselves in Beaufort. Blackbeard and his colleagues, 40 white men and 60 Negroes, clambered aboard the Spanish sloop and departed, taking all the company's plunder with them, about 2,500 pounds. 'Twas generally believed the said Thatch run his vessel aground on purpose, Harriet later told authorities, so that he could break up the companies and to secure what monies and effects he had got for himself. When Bonnet returned with his pardon 3 days later, the Revenge was waiting for him in Beaufort, but the treasure was gone. He rescued the Bogue Bank castaways and vowed to avenge himself on his double-crossing mentor. Little did Bonnet know, but Blackbeard had also sailed to Bath, taking the outer passage around the barrier islands rather than the shallow sound inside them. As Bonnet was sailing back to Beaufort, his nemesis had been just on the other side of the barrier islands, headed in the opposite direction. About the time Bonnet discovered his treachery, Blackbeard's 8-gun sloop was making its way up a narrow creek leading to North Carolina's unassuming capital. Although Bath was North Carolina's administrative center, oldest town, and official port of entry, it was little more than a village. 3 long streets, 2 dozen homes, a grist mill, and a small wooden fort set along Bath Creek, whose cypress-covered banks were so low, flat, and marshy, it was impossible to tell where the water ended and land began. Blackbeard's sloop came into the wind and anchored in the brown, tannin-stained water, the town on one side, a wharf and plantation house on the other. Bath's 100 or so residents couldn't help but take notice of their visitors. With their arrival, the town's population doubled. Upon coming ashore, the pirates may well have asked where to find the courthouse or seat of government, and residents would have informed them that North Carolina had neither. The governing council was migratory, meeting at one member's home or another, sometimes many miles from the village. To take the king's pardon, Blackbeard was advised to row over to the wharf across the creek. Governor Charles Eden's house was at the end of it. No eyewitness accounts of the initial meeting between Blackbeard and Governor Eden have survived, but apparently it went well. Eden, 45, was a wealthy English noble with a 400-acre estate, but he governed an impoverished colony, a pestilent backwater populated by aggrieved Indians and penniless settlers. Blackbeard's men had money, 2,500 pounds in Spanish coin, in addition to whatever they had saved from their previous year of piracy, and the means and inclination to bring in more, as long as the governor refrained from asking too many questions about where it was from. They came to an understanding. Eden would issue pardons to all of Blackbeard's men, most of whom would disperse. Blackbeard and a handful of his closest lieutenants would settle down in Bath, however, building homes and leading what might appear on the surface to be honest lives. In reality, they would quietly continue to detain vessels heading up and down the eastern seaboard or to and from nearby Virginia, whose haughty leaders had long looked down their noses at their backward southern neighbors. Eden and his friends would fence their goods, and the pirates would benefit from their protection. North Carolina would become, in effect, the new Bahamas, only better in that it had a sovereign government and was therefore not subject to a British invasion. Most of Blackbeard's company promptly left North Carolina for Pennsylvania and New York. William Howard went to Williamsburg with 2 slaves, one taken with La Concorde, the other from the brigantine Princess. Blackbeard and 20 other men, including at least 6 free black pirates, stayed in Bath. According to local tradition, Thatch took up residence on Plum Point, a promontory on the edge of the village. According to the author of A General History of the Pirates, Blackbeard promptly married a young creature of about 16 years of age, the governor performing the ceremony, allegedly his 14th wife, whom he would force to prostitute herself with 5 or 6 of his brutal companions as he watched. The story is greatly embellished. Thatch would not have found the time to marry 14 women given the amount of time he had spent at sea. With his remarkably humane track record as a pirate, it's doubtful that he would have arranged for his teenage bride to be regularly gang-raped. Thatch did marry someone in Bath, however, as his nuptials were later remarked on by a Royal Navy captain based in neighboring Virginia, who had been keeping tabs on his activities. Local lore holds that this bride was Mary Ormond, daughter of a future sheriff of Bath, a story supported by at least one of Ormond's early 20th century descendants. Another Blackbeard story in the general history rings true. He often diverted himself with going ashore among the planters, where he reveled night and day. By these people he was well received, but whether out of love or fear, I cannot say. Like Henry Avery, Thatch had bought the loyalty of a colonial governor, but had yet to accumulate the sort of fortune that would allow him to live like a king for the rest of his days. Therefore, after a few weeks of rest, he returned to work. Back in the Bahamas, Charles Vane had no intention of taking his activities underground. After his April cruise, he had spent nearly a month stewing in Nassau waiting for Jacobite reinforcements. These were not to come. Shortly after George Cammack forwarded his Bahamian plan to James Stuart's mother, Queen Mary of Modena, she passed away, the plot apparently dying with her. As the weeks passed, Vane realized that Woods Rogers, George I's governor, was going to beat the Stuarts to Nassau. The pirate republic, he was coming to realize, was likely doomed. Hornigold and other reformed pirates who had returned to Nassau intended to place themselves in Governor Rogers's service. Jennings had gone further than that, having taken a privateering commission from Governor Bennett to hunt Vane down and bring him back to Bermuda to be tried for his crimes. He was said to be fitting out 2 or 3 sloops to come to Nassau for that purpose. Vane wished to continue piracy, but was aware that the walls were closing in on him. By late May, Vane could wait no longer. He went around Nassau calling up his old crew. 75 like-minded diehards agreed to join him on the Lark, including Edward England and Calico Jack Rackham. The plan was to go out on one last cruise before Governor Rogers showed up, and hopefully acquire a larger pirate vessel, one capable of operating without a home port for long periods of time. If Vane was to be pushed out of the pirate's nest, he wanted to be ready to fly as long and as far as necessary to find another. Vane's first capture was an audacious one. On May 23, 1718, near Crooked Island, Bahamas, 200 miles southeast of Nassau, they overtook a familiar vessel. The 14-ton sloop Richard and John had been a fixture in Nassau for many years, bringing supplies to the pirates from Charleston and Jamaica and trading them for pirate plunder. Vane and everyone else aboard the Lark knew it belonged to Richard Thompson, the leading citizen of Harbor Island, and his son-in-law, John Cockrum, one of the founders of the Pirate Republic, who had sailed canoes with Hornigold back in 1714. The Richard and John had always been off-limits to pirates, but not this time. Cockrum had been a leading member of the pro-pardon camp and was no friend to Vane and his men. They fired on the Richard and John, forcing her captain, Cockrum's brother Joseph, to come into the wind and surrender. Vane's crew dumped him on the forlorn shores of Crooked Island and sailed away with his sloop. Vane was making a clear statement. In his book, reformed pirates were fair game. In the first half of June, Vane captured several more vessels, including a 2-masted boat and a 20-gun French ship. The 2-masted boat was turned over to Edward England, and the crew voted the flamboyantly dressed John Rackham to replace him as the company's quartermaster. The French ship, a substantial 200 to 250-ton vessel, was well-suited to piracy, and Vane adopted it as his new flagship. After being disarmed, the Lark was apparently given to the Frenchman. On June 23rd, cruising outside the French port of Léogane, near modern-day Port-au-Prince, Haiti, they seized another French vessel, the brigantine Saint-Martin of Bordeaux, carrying sugar, indigo, brandy, claret, and white wine. Vane dumped her captain and several passengers on the shore, but kept the Saint-Martin and 13 of her crewmen. Satisfied with these prizes and fortified with drink, Vane's company agreed to return to Nassau. Vane in his French ship, England in the two-masted boat, and the Saint-Martin and Richard and John sailed by prize cruise. With these large vessels, the pirates were forced to take the deep water passage around Harbor Island and Eleuthera. This route took longer than cutting directly across the Bahama Bank, but it proved fortuitous. On the morning of July 4th, the pirate flotilla found themselves among a small swarm of trading sloops heading in and out of Harbor Island. In just a few hours, the pirates captured three of them, the Drake of Rhode Island, Captain John Draper, carrying wine, spirits, and rum, the Ulster of New York, John Fred, loaded with tropical timber from Andros Island, and the Eagle of Rhode Island, Robert Brown, with sugar, bread, and two barrels of nails. No treasure fleet this, but the sloops would make good tenders, and the alcohol would keep the men happy for a few days, at least. That evening, Vane's convoy of prizes arrived in Nassau, where his men promptly seized two more sloops, the Dove, William Harris, and the Lancaster, commanded by none other than Neil Walker, the son of former Justice Thomas Walker, whose family Hornigold had driven off New Providence in 1716. Vane had left Nassau with a single sloop 6 weeks earlier, but was now in control of at least nine vessels. He quickly consolidated control over the island. He is said to have stormed ashore with his sword drawn, threatening to burn the principal houses of the town and to make examples of many of the people. Vane moved against Benjamin Hornigold and other reformed pirates, making examples of many of the people, and acting extremely insolent to all who were not as great villains as himself, according to the author of A General History of the Pirates, who had excellent sources in Nassau. He reigned here as governor for 20 days, stopped all vessels which came in, and would suffer none to go out. He swore that while he was in the harbor, he would suffer no other governor than himself. His opponents cowed, Vane and his men set to work transferring cargo from the Saint-Martin to various sloops, and shifting additional cannon aboard the big French ship. His gang intended to sail for the coast of Brazil, where they could hope to join forces with La Buse, Condent, and other die-hard pirates. Maybe another pirate republic could be built on the shores of South America, beyond the reach of the Hanoverian king, where the pirates could regroup. On the evening of July 24th, 1718, with Vane's men just 3 or 4 days from departure, the cry went out. The sails of a Royal Navy frigate had been spotted coming round the backside of Hog Island. Woods Rogers had arrived. Chapter 10. Brinksmanship. July to September, 1718. Woods Rogers stood on the quarterdeck of the Delicia, cane in hand to support his bad foot, and peered out across the sea. His great ship heeled gently to starboard, her sails set close to the wind, the shadowy outline of New Providence Island 3 miles off her bow, dominating the southern horizon. Commodore Peter Chamberlain's flagship, HMS Milford, sailed alongside, lookouts atop her mainmast and 30 heavy guns at the ready. Behind, in the Delicia's sizzling wake, the transport Willing Mind rode low in the waves with her heavy load of soldiers and supplies, with the private sloop of war Buck sailing nearby. From time to time, Rogers peered through his looking glass to pick out the frigate HMS Rose, a lighted lantern hanging in her mizzenmast, now rounding the western end of Hog Island, 3 miles away. He could see the sloop of war HMS Shark hanging a half mile behind her. In the wee hours of the morning, Commodore Chamberlain had put local pilots aboard the Rose and Shark and sent them ahead to Nassau to scout out the scene. Now, 15 hours later, the moment of reckoning had come. The Rose was entering the harbor. Rogers and Chamberlain, lacking pilots for their large, deep-draft ships, planned to spend the night sailing back and forth out in the deep water. Until daybreak, they could only wait, watching and listening for reports from the Rose and Shark. Rogers felt a sinking feeling when a few minutes later he heard the unmistakable sound of cannon fire echoing from inside Nassau's harbor. At 6:30 p.m., the captain of the Rose, Thomas Whitney, ordered the frigate's anchors dropped just inside the harbor's main entrance. She swung into the easterly wind, so that her 20 guns pointed uselessly at stretches of unoccupied shoreline, the tip of Hog Island to port, the shrubby, overgrown fields outside of Nassau to starboard. The main anchorage lay dead ahead, a scene of desolation. The remains of some 40 captured vessels were strewn on the shore, some burnt, and all of them ruined. Dutch ships, French brigantines, sloops of various sizes and nationalities, fittings and sails missing, and stray ends of rigging blowing in the wind. In the middle of the anchorage, a large 20-to-30-gun ship, French-built by the look of her, rode at anchor, a St. George's flag flying from her mainmast, a sign of allegiance to Old England rather than the decade-old nation of Great Britain. Sloops and other vessels were anchored all around her, some flying the Death's Head flag. The same flag could be seen flapping over Fort Nassau, whose seaward-facing walls were so decrepit their cracks were visible from a distance. The wind carried the sickening smell of putrefying flesh across the harbor, as if the carcasses of 1,000 animals were rotting somewhere on the shore. Suddenly, to Whitney's alarm, a flash of fire and a puff of smoke appeared from the stern of the big ship, Charles Vane's ship, in the center of the harbor. The sound came moments later, the report of a stern-mounted cannon, followed by the splash of a cannonball on the surface of the water not far from the Rose. 2 more cannonballs passed over his head, at least one tearing through some of the Rose's rigging, before Whitney raised a white flag of truce. Clearly, the young captain must have thought this was not going to be easy. With a pirate ship appearing to accept the flag of truce, Whitney sent his lieutenant into the harbor in a boat to, in his words, know the reason for the pirate's hostility. The lieutenant went alongside Vane's ship and hailed her captain, inquiring why he had fired on the king's ship. His answer, Whitney wrote in his logbook, was that he would use his utmost endeavor to burn us and all the vessels in the harbor. Vane also gave the lieutenant a letter addressed to Governor Woods Rogers, on the outside of which was written, "We await a speedy answer." The letter, which may or may not have been delivered to Rogers that evening, read, July 24, 1718. "Your Excellency may please to understand that we are willing to accept His Majesty's most gracious pardon on the following terms, viz., that you will suffer us to dispose of all our goods now in our possession, likewise to act as we think fit, with everything belonging to us, as His Majesty's Act of Grace specifies. If Your Excellency shall please to comply with this, we shall with all readiness accept of His Majesty's Act of Grace. If not, we are obliged to stand on our own defense. Your humble servants, Charles Vane and Company." Vane was simply trying to buy a little time to find a way to escape from New Providence with his new ship and all his loot. His ship was too large to pass over the Potter's Cay Bar and through the harbor's shallow eastern passage. The Rose was anchored in the western entrance, bottling him in the harbor. and he thought of trying to run past her guns, exchanging comparable broadsides, was put to rest when, a few minutes later, the 10-gun HMS Shark sailed into the harbor and anchored just ahead of the Rose, followed by the 20-gun transport Willing Mind and the 10-gun privateer Buck. Vane's ship was trapped, her men at the mercy of Governor Rogers' forces. The sun set, plunging the harbor into darkness. Vane stewed for a few hours until he finally decided Rogers did not intend to honor him with a reply. His company agreed that the warships at the harbor's entrance seemed to speak for themselves. The ship was doomed, Vane told them, but there was still a way to escape the governor's clutches. The 90 men and his crew listened intently as he outlined a daring escape plan. At 2 a.m., Captain Whitney was awakened in his cabin by a breathless subordinate. The pirates were attacking. The Rose was in danger. He rushed onto deck and was greeted by a horrific sight. Vane's ship, enveloped in flames, was heading straight for the Rose and her consorts. In the middle of the night, Vane's men had unloaded their ship and soaked its decks and rigging with pitch and tar. They had rolled all her guns out of their ports, every one packed with powder and 2 cannonballs. Weighing anchor, they had quietly towed her in the direction of the interlopers. As the distance closed, one pirate stayed on the helm, keeping the ship aimed directly at the anchored Shark and Rose, while others dashed about the doomed ship, lowering sails and setting the pitch-soaked decks and rigging alight. If all went to plan, the ship would collide with the Royal Navy vessels, consuming them in the resulting conflagration. As the last pirates abandoned their ship, sailors were rushing about the decks of the Rose, Shark, Buck, and Willing Mind, some loosening sails, others hacking away at the anchor lines with axes, trying to free the endangered vessels. As soon as the anchors came free, Whitney and the other captains swung their ships around, wind to their backs, toward the open sea. There was a frightening few minutes as the fireship drew closer, the first of her double-loaded guns discharging as their gunpowder charges ignited in the heat. Then, slowly, the Rose and the other vessels gained momentum and pulled away from the approaching inferno. Vane himself watched these events from the deck of the Catherine, a swift Bermuda-built sloop that he had commandeered from another pirate in the middle of the night. Catherine's owner, a minor pirate named Charles Yates, remained on board and was none too happy about having his vessel taken from him. Vane's men had loaded their possessions into the sloop and augmented her armament to 10 or 12 guns. They watched with disappointment as the Rose and Shark escaped out to sea, but the action had bought them time. In the 4 hours remaining until sunrise, they would have the run of Nassau. Vane sent men into town to seize anything they thought useful, equipment, supplies, weapons, valuables, and the island's best pilot and carpenter, whom they roused out of bed and carried aboard the Catherine. Then they waited, black flag at the mast, for the dawn. At 7 a.m., shortly after daybreak, Rogers's entire fleet appeared at the entrance to the harbor. The governor's first glimpse of his new capital was of the smoldering timbers of a large ship bobbing in the middle of the channel, embers hissing, the boneyard of ruined vessels on the shore, and a pair of pirate vessels anchored up the harbor, just behind Potter's Cay. If he had wished to make a dignified entrance, Rogers was disappointed. On their way into the harbor, both the Delicia and Milford ran aground on a sandbar, and had to wait 2 hours for the rising tide to lift them off. Vane's men presumably had a good laugh, watching ships bearing the governor and Commodore's personal flags loll on the Hog Island sandbar. The laughing stopped around 10 o'clock when, with the tide now high, the shallow-drafted Buck and another sloop began sailing around Potter's Cay Bar, their decks filled with soldiers. Vane knew they had lingered long enough. He ordered anchors lifted and sails raised. The Catherine turned and headed out the narrow eastern entrance of the harbor, with the Buck in hot pursuit. The winds blew strong from the south-southeast that morning, and the chase proceeded close on the wind. Vane had a worried few hours, as the Catherine proved slower than her pursuers on this point of sail. He was relieved when they finally rounded the eastern end of New Providence, let out their sails, and began gaining ground. Vane's men fired their guns in defiance, and the Buck was forced to give up the chase and return to Nassau. Vane and his men were to remain at large, but New Providence Island, for the time being at least, would be in the possession of Governor Rogers. On the morning of the 27th, Rogers landed ashore, an event punctuated by much pomp. The Rose and Shark fired 11-gun salutes as Rogers's boat hit the beach, where, to his considerable relief, he was joyously received by pro-pardon residents. Thomas Walker, who had returned to the island in recent weeks, was the first to greet the governor, along with his old nemesis, Benjamin Hornigold. These two men, the pirate governor and the former justice, led Rogers and his entourage to the crumbling mass of Fort Nassau. Along the way, the crews of several pardoned pirate captains, Hornigold, Josiah Burgess, and others, formed orderly lines on either side of the road, each man firing his musket into the air as Rogers walked past, creating a running salute all the way to the fortress gates. Rogers climbed to the top of the fort to address the gathering crowd. He could see in an instant that the fort was in terrible disrepair. The seaward-facing bastion looked like it might collapse at any moment, having, as Rogers put it, only a crazy cracked wall in its foundation. The parade ground was overgrown with weeds, and instead of longhouses for the garrison, it contained a single hut in which a pathetic old man was living. The pirates had absconded with the cannon, leaving behind a single 9-pounder, which explained why Vane hadn't tried to hole up in the fort. By the time Rogers reached the roof, William Fairfax, Walker, and Hornigold at his side, and a group of soldiers behind, some 300 people had assembled in the square below. Rogers unrolled a scroll and read aloud the king's commission, appointing him governor of the Bahamas. The people, Rogers said, showed many tokens of joy for the reintroduction of government. Rogers spent the next few days consolidating control of the island and surveying its conditions. His 100-man independent company took control of Fort Nassau, constructing shelters out of sticks and palmetto leaves, while the sea-weary colonists set about building tents made from sails borrowed from the Delicia, Buck, and Willing Mind. Sailors from the Rose secured in the name of the king the Saint-Martin, Drake, Ulster, Dove, Lancaster, and other vessels that happened to be in the harbor. Rogers moved into the old governor's house, one of the only buildings that had survived the War of Spanish Succession. In his makeshift office, he had consultations with various residents, looking for inhabitants who had not been pirates, that were the least encouragers of trading with them, to serve on his 12-man governing council. His initial appointees, announced on August 1st, included Harbor Island smuggling king Richard Thompson and several men who had come with Rogers, including Fairfax, the new justice, and the Delicia's captain and first mate. The council met at Rogers' house that very day and spent hours accepting the surrenders of some 200 pirates who had not yet taken the king's pardon. The pirate population on the island was estimated at 500 to 700, suggesting that a great number of those who had left Nassau to accept pardons in other colonies had come back. Another 200 non-pirates were also on the island, people who, in the words of one of Rogers's officials, had made their escape from ye Spaniards during the war, and now lived in the woods, destitute of all necessaries. Rogers set all of these people to work, clearing a thick layer of vegetation the pirates had allowed to smother buildings, yards, and fields. Others were recruited to assist the soldiers in arming and repairing the fort, and in setting up a separate battery to guard the harbor's eastern entrance. The last vessel in Rogers's fleet, the supply ship Samuel finally arrived, safe and sound in the harbor, her capacious hold filled with food and supplies. After the first week of his governorship, Rogers was likely optimistic for success. Reports of piracy in the surrounding waters shattered the mood. First came a message from Charles Vane, who had detained two inbound vessels and said that he would join with Blackbeard, planning, as Rogers described it, to burn my guardship and visit me very soon to return the affront I gave him on my arrival in sending two sloops after him instead of answering him. Shortly thereafter, on August 4th, a Philadelphia mariner named Richard Taylor arrived with more ominous news. Taylor had been captured in the southern Bahamas by Spanish privateers, who, despite the peace, had proceeded to sack the English villages on Cat Island and Crooked Island. The leader of the privateers had told Taylor that a new Spanish governor had arrived in Havana with orders from King Philip to destroy all the English settlements in the Bahama Islands. He had 5 warships and upward of 1,500 men to accomplish this task. If the English surrendered, Taylor explained, the Spanish governor had instructions to deport them to Virginia or the Carolinas, but in case of resistance, to send them to Havana and thence as prisoners to Old Spain. Facing simultaneous threats from Charles Vane and the King of Spain, Rogers knew he needed to complete his fortifications as quickly as possible. Unfortunately, his labor supply began to disappear. First, the soldiers, sailors, and colonists he brought with him fell ill by the dozens. The unidentified disease and the putrid stench that had hung over the town for weeks was blamed on the huge piles of rotting animal hides the pirates had abandoned on the shore. Although the illness had broken out 2 weeks before Rogers's arrival, he wrote it was as if only fresh European blood could draw the infection. Long-time residents quickly became free of contagion, while the newcomers were seized so violently that I have had above 100 sick at one time, and not a single healthful officer. 86 of Rogers's party died, as did 6 crewmen from the Rose and Milford, and 2 of the locals who served on Rogers's governing council. Rogers himself came down with intestine commotions and contagious distempers, and by mid-August was unable to attend council meetings. Most of the island's cattle also perished, striking a blow to the food supply. Longtime Nassau residents resisted not only the illness, but Rogers's efforts to put them to work. Most of them are poor and so addicted to idleness that they would choose rather almost to starve than work, Rogers reported home. They mortally hate it, for after they have cleared a patch that will supply them with potatoes and yams and very little else, and fish being so plentiful, and either turtle or iguanas available on the neighboring islands, they eat them instead of meat, and covet no stock or cattle. Thus they live poorly and indolently, and pray for nothing but shipwrecks or the pirates, and would rather spend all they have in a punch-house than pay me a tax to save their families and all that is dear to them. The locals proved unreliable militiamen as well. These wretches can't be kept to watch at night, and when they do, they come very seldom sober and rarely stay awake all night, though our officers or soldiers very often surprise their guard and carry off their arms and punish, fine or confine them, almost every day, the governor complained. I don't fear but they'll all stand by me in case of any invasion attempt, except one by pirates. But should their old friends have strength enough to design to attack me, I much doubt whether I should find one half to join me. It was at this time that Commodore Chamberlain announced that his 3 men of war were leaving. Rogers was flabbergasted. The colony was at its most vulnerable, its defenders ill, and its fortifications unfinished. The Milford, Rose, Shark, and the 300 men serving on them were essential to its defense. Chamberlain was adamant, however. He had cleaned his vessel's hull, taken his share of the loot seized from pirate prizes in the harbor, and, frankly, had no orders to stay any longer. Rogers had no power over naval personnel, and so was forced to beg the Commodore not to abandon the colony. Begrudgingly, Chamberlain agreed to leave the 20-gun Rose behind for 3 weeks longer, at which point Rogers said he was in hopes my men and the fortification would be in a better state to stand alone against the pirates and Spaniards. Accordingly, at 9:30 a.m. on August 16th, the Milford and Shark departed for New York.
This audiobook is continued on Disc 10.